With all the social and political issues facing the country, can universities be a big part of the solution?
How can we together create something that's better than what either of us can do alone?
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll see how generous thinking can lead us to an answer. We'll also learn funny with one of the kids in the hall and spend an academic minute hearing women's voices from the past. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Higher education occupies a difficult place in 21st century American culture. Colleges and universities, institutions that bear so much responsibility for the future health of our nation, seem to be sometimes at odds with the very public they're intended to serve. In her new book called Generous Thinking, A Radical Approach to Saving the University, Kathleen Fitzpatrick says it is imperative that we recenter the mission of the university to rebuild that lost trust. Dr. Kathleen Fitzpatrick is Director of Digital Humanities and a professor of English at Michigan State University. I asked her why she took on this project.
Well, I had just spent a lot of time paying attention to the ways that, first of all, in the public sphere, we find ourselves increasingly unable to carry on conversations with one another across lines of difference, places where we disagree. And I was puzzling through how we might, you know, be able to listen to one another better and be able to come to greater understanding of what people who are different from us might be thinking. At the same time, I was noticing the degree to which universities today are finding themselves under different kinds of threat, whether it's from budget cuts or from privatization of what had been public services, or from perceptions that universities are responsible for massive loads of student debt and so forth. And it occurred to me that these two problems were related, that we really need to think much more deeply about the relationship between higher education today and the publics that institutions of higher education are meant to serve, and think about how those of us who work on college and university campuses are communicating with the publics that we want to better understand and support the institutions that we work for. And so that was the genesis of the book.
And you're thinking of higher thoughts, not just, you know, town and gown relationships, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not just town and gown, because I do think that the work that's going on college and university campuses has much broader application to a lot of the major crises that our culture is facing today, whether it's the impact of climate change, or it's economic issues, or it's just general issues of cultural understanding. I think that a lot of what's happening on university campuses can really illuminate what's happening within these moments of crisis, but only if the work that we're doing on campus can be heard, and only if we've built up positive relationships with the audiences that we're trying to reach.
Have universities just been seen by the general public at large in their home cities as just, you know, an economic center?
I think that that is by and large true, and it's been something that's been building since the 1980s. There was a moment during the rise of the GI Bill and during the midpoint of the 20th century when we really understood that the university was a place that provided a broad-based education that enabled real social mobility and social interaction. But what we understand that social mobility to be today, since the 1980s, has become increasingly economic in orientation. orientation, and it's become increasingly private in orientation as well. So we're in a moment when the purpose of a higher education, as it's broadly understood, is to get a credential that can get you a job that can allow you to provide for your family. And that's an extremely important thing, and I don't want to dismiss that, but that education can do a whole lot of other broader socially oriented, community oriented things too, that I think we've begun to forget. And so part of what I'm after in this book is to really encourage us to think about our universities as being a space of really broad social interaction and community interaction that can help us build stronger relationships in a whole lot of different ways.
I want to get to the title of the book because it's a striking phrase. What is generous thinking?
Generous thinking is what I believe that the university has the potential to model for our culture. It's a mode of engaging with other people, other ideas, other cultures in a way that is open and receptive and thoughtful about what those other people and ideas might be bringing to the table. And that works in a positive way to try and build something new rather than beginning from the position that you are wrong and I am right, and my job in this conversation is to demonstrate to you your wrongness. So generous thinking begins from, well, you know, what if in fact you are right? What can I learn from what you have to say? And how can we together create something that's better than what either of us can do alone?
Do you think that is the answer between the crisis that you find with universities and public?
I think it's one answer. I don't think it will solve everything all by itself. But I do think that beginning from a position in which, you know, we on campus, those of us who teach on college campuses, those of us who are in the administration, if we can begin to be better listeners and to find out what people who are coming to us, whether it's students coming to us for their educations, parents coming to us with their children to say, I want you to help my child have a better life. Or if it's members of our immediate communities or the broader world who are concerned about issues that we have an interest in, that maybe by listening better to what the concerns of those who are coming to us are, we might better be able to work together to solve some of those problems and to think about what a better future for our culture might look like.
One of the issues you talk about in the book is the intense competition now between colleges and universities between themselves.
Yes.
Is there any way around that?
I believe there is, but I think it's going to take some fairly radical change. It's going to take universities, and particularly the upper administrations of those colleges and universities, recognizing that the competition that they are in is not serving any of us well. It's creating a sense of hierarchy when, in fact, we as a sector could better be working together to share resources, to draw on common strengths, and to build something that will serve all of us, rather than simply trying to figure out whether College A is better than College B and by what metric. I think this is something that happens on college campuses as well. You know, we are in this constant culture of competition in which we're competing for scarce resources. And so faculty are pitted against one another in order to figure out who's going to get to take a sabbatical next year, or who's going to get to do a particular research project, or who's going to get a claim for being first to make some kind of discovery. And that level of competition, I think, is really detrimental to the health both within our institutions of the communities that we work with and of the institutions themselves, because we wind up privileging a bunch of things that don't actually matter to us in a much deeper level. That if our values are about, you know, collectively creating knowledge together and building a better world, we end up leaving that behind when we privilege the things that make us individually, personally receive some kind of acclaim.
I recently spoke to the authors of another book about that topic of the state of universities today, And one of the points they made, and you do kind of make it in your book too, is that this is the only industry that kind of brags about how many customers they reject.
Well, that's it exactly. I mean, that the rankings among colleges and universities are determined very much by how few people they serve rather than how many they serve. And that seems pretty perverse, quite frankly. But this is built into so many academic institutions and other services. Fellowships are more prestigious the more people they reject. Journals are more prestigious to publish in the more articles that they reject, and so on. The more exclusive something is, the greater its prestige. And so because of that, we end up with this world in which we're all constantly competing for something that seems scarce, when in fact the scarcity has been somewhat artificially created. And if we can think about how we might instead measure ourselves by the quantity of the good that we do, we might begin to find a way out of this constant sense of competition and build something more productive.
You note in the book that you posted this online over a year ago and invited discussion about the topic. How much did that change or shape this book?
Oh, really, quite significantly. I posted the entire manuscript with the blessing of my press for an open peer review process. And so, you know, in a traditional peer review process, the press will send the manuscript to two or three reviewers who will write anonymized reports on their reading of the book and will give advice for how to revise it and so forth. And it's an extremely important process for academic work to get that feedback from the field and to make sure that the work is as strong as possible. But 2 to 3 perspectives are just not that broad. I had nearly 40 readers who came in and commented on various parts of the manuscript and who were willing to share with me in an open and public fashion their thoughts about the directions that I was headed. And, you know, some of those comments, you know, one of the fears about open peer review processes is that everybody's going to pull their punches, right? They're going to all be nice instead of being critical in a way that can help make work better. And I will tell you that some of the comments on the review process online were quite critical. They were very serious in pointing out to me places where I wasn't thinking deeply enough about a particular kind of question, or places where I was ignoring perspectives that I needed to bring into my own thinking in order to open up some of the ideas that I had. And because there were so many different perspectives among these 40 people, I feel like I got a much broader view of what the book was able to do and what it wasn't yet ready for, and how I could make it into something better. And I think that mode of working in the open, that mode of being public with the work that is happening on university campuses, is a really key component of generous thinking, of being able to show our processes in action and allow people who have an interest in the same things that we care about to participate with us in the development of those ideas.
You do touch on one thing in the book that I think is going to be very important in the future, and that is the topic of media literacy and teaching young people and older people, for that matter, how to consume media. Should that be required in the future?
I increasingly believe that it should be, and that we need to think fairly seriously about what media literacy means. In some senses, you know, media literacy is about the ability to use and to produce new cultural forms, right? The ability to make video or to understand how video works. But it's also really about reading sensitively and understanding who is saying what in the media landscape and how it should be interpreted. I think it's crucial that we begin to, at a very, very young age, work with students in thinking about what the messages that are coming to them through the media are, how they're coming to them, how the media forms that communicate with them shape the possibilities for understanding, and how they can also contribute to the media culture that we live in more productive ways. When we find ourselves in a moment in social media in which you know, the messages that are circulating around us, we don't actually know where they're originating. We don't know at times about how true the things we're being told are. And we don't get, I think, a very nuanced sense of what it means to be connected to the people around us. Instead, we get, you know, very flat, superficial representations of the things that are happening around us. We have a tendency to communicate with people with whom we already agree. And the result is our ability to communicate outside our immediate circles becomes even more narrowed and circumscribed than it's been. So I do think that media literacy is a really key component of asking all of us to think carefully about what we're consuming and about the messages that we're producing as well.
All right. Well, finally, look ahead. Are you hopeful that this can be fixed? And I guess the other one is, are you hopeful that it will be fixed?
Oh, that's a really tough one. I am somewhat natively an optimist. And so I want very much to believe that it can be fixed. And I do believe that among people of goodwill, you know, particularly on college campuses, there are a lot of people who genuinely believe that there's more generous work for the university to do, that there are better connections possible with the world around us, and that we can make the institution into something that isn't fostering competition, but that is instead really reaching out in a positive way to the world. Will it go that way? Only if a whole lot of us are willing to commit to that process, and only if a whole lot of us are really willing to do the hard work of stepping outside our own perspectives, of listening to others, and of really thinking about the work that we're trying to do in a more socially oriented, collective fashion rather than as serving our own individual goals.
Dr. Kathleen Fitzpatrick is Director of Digital Humanities and a Professor of English at Michigan State University. Her new book is called Generous Thinking, A Radical Approach to Saving the University. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Still to come, a member of a beloved comedy troupe wants to make you funnier. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Can you teach funny? That's one of the questions we asked Kevin McDonald when we spoke recently. Kevin is a founding member of the improv comedy group The Kids in the Hall. Among his acting and comedy projects, he also travels around conducting workshops for people who want to learn how to write and perform comedy. He says he may just have this comedy thing all figured out.
Well, during my whole life, as I started being a professional comedian in my early 20s, I came up with these theories, and the kids in the hall, we just did things by instinct, but I'm sort of anal and professorial, though they would disagree with that, and I sort of I figured out what we were doing, and then when I got drunk at parties, I get more boring, and the thing about comedy is, and then I had these theories that I was boring people at parties, and then in 2012, I had just moved from Los Angeles to keep making a living besides just writing and stuff. And there's lots of, I'm doing lots of things, don't worry about me. But one of them I thought was teaching these theories, which I actually love doing. I can never make money by doing something I don't love. And so I go around the towns on the occasional weekend. I teach these workshops during the day and I perform at night. And the workshops are, though we didn't know what we were doing at the time, like I said, in my professorial, I don't know if I'm saying that word right, way, I sort of figured out what we're doing, and I teach the workshop students how to write sketch comedy through improv, which is the original way that we started writing. I'll stop talking now.
Can you teach anybody this? Can you teach funny?
People ask me this all the time, and you can't teach people to be funny, but you can teach people to be funnier if that's what they want. If they just want to learn how to write a bit, then they improve a bit there if I'm doing my job. And just acting on stage, it's all a part of it. Because when you're writing through improv, it's about writing and rehearsing. It's about writing and performing. It's like everything is encompassed. And then I always tell them, if you're encouraged by this, keep doing it. The best way to get better at sketch comedy, and I guess in a small way, the best way to get funnier is by doing it all the time. Doing it all the time, and you invisibly get better without you know. Audiences will notice it if they keep coming back. You won't notice it, but it will happen.
If I could, let's go back and just, how did the kids get started?
Well, I guess I got kicked out of acting college for being a one-legged actor, the one leg being comedy. Though the guy that kicked me out, the head of the acting college, he was a one-legged actor because a lighting grid had fallen on his leg during a production of Pippin, and he was limping around me telling me I was a one-legged actor. Anyway, I went to Second City. I eventually met Dave Foley. We had comedy chemistry right away. We didn't know each other's names, but we met doing the old actor mirror exercise. And by the end of that three-hour class, we started a comedy troupe. It's like falling in love, comedy chemistry. And we were in Toronto, we were the original Kids in the Hall, Dave Foley and I, and a guy named Luciano Casimiri, who was also brilliant, but quit a year or two later, or 3 years later, because of stage fright. And there was another troupe in Calgary called The Audience. They had Bruce McCullough and Mark McKinney and Norm Hiscock in it, who later we hired to be a writer with us. He's like a kid in the hall you don't see. He quit performing because he just got married. He wanted a job, so he became cameraman for news. Anyway, the audience in Calgary were so big, they moved to Toronto. And again, it was like comedy love at comedy first sight. We had a comedy crush in each other, the two groups. There were nine of us at one point, and people kept quitting either because of stage fright or because they got great jobs writing for TV and radio. Though those shows never ended up getting done, but they wrote for a few months and made a little money. And then Scott Thompson, he saw us and forced his way into the troupe by jumping on stage all the time. And that's how it became the five of us.
Is getting something that successful that early in your career a gift, or is it just something you got to walk around with all the time?
Well, we weren't that successful. We're cult successful. Because we're slightly off the beaten path. We go slightly over. Though we love, you know, as kids, we love Jerry Lewis, and we love, you know, we love comedy. But also, I don't know how it is. We're just, you put us together, and we're a little odd. Scott Thompson always says this when people ask him the difference between us and Saturday Night Live. He says that if Kids in the Hall and Saturday Night Live were both lemonades, Saturday Night Live would be that sweet lemonade that everybody likes. Everybody likes sweet lemonade. But we're that kind of, we're lemonade without sugar. We're sort of the bitter sweet lemonade. And not a lot of people love that kind of lemonade, but the people who love it, love it! And that's how you get a cult following.
Well, let's go back to the workshop. Once you're done with the people in your workshop, how are they going to participate in the show later on?
What we do, since I teach them how to write sketches through improv, we create sketches through improv. The second half of the workshop, like for 3 hours or 4 hours, I force them to improvise because I teach them first. I just talk. I guess you can call it a lecture. Hopefully it's a fun lecture for an hour. I teach them the process. I make them do warm-up games. And then I split them into groups, and they all improvise. And there's like three or four groups, let's say. After each improv, I jump on stage, and I lead the class in notes. I give most of them, of course. And then with my help for the afternoon, we have a lunch break for an hour, and then in the afternoon, the group split up. I walk from group to group to group, and we turn those improvs into comedy sketches. We don't write them down on paper because we're writing through improv, but once we know what we're doing, we put everything up on its feet and rehearse it because, like I said, writing and rehearsing is the same thing when you write through improv, and you do it four or five times as a rehearsal just with your group until you sort of get the lines in your head, and you're allowed to ad-lib on stage, and then we do a run-through. We do a couple run-throughs, because after the first run-through, I give notes. It sounds boring, but it isn't. And then by the second run-through, they're ready, and they're part of the show that night.
That sounds like it's going to be a great time. Like, I got two more things for you, and this is just stuff for me. One, you were in the greatest Star Trek movie that was never made, Galaxy Quest. I love that movie.
That was fun. I auditioned for the lead alien part. Thank God I didn't get it. That guy was great. I forget his name, but he's also Canadian. And the director was a Kids in the Hall fan, so he asked me, like, if they gave the part to the guy who deserved it. And then he said, you just want to come down for a week, and we don't have any lines for your character, but you can just ad-lib for a week. And that was tons of fun. So I enjoyed it, and it's a good movie. It's one of the movies I've done that I'm not embarrassed about.
And I will say that if you Google Kevin MacDonald instead of Kevin McDonald, you end up with...
A Scottish director comes out.
Well, actually, an evolutionary psychologist.
Yeah, I'm like a scientist of comedy. If you want to go pretentious, I can say that.
Kevin MacDonald is a founding member of the Kids in the Hall. You can check his schedule of workshops at kidsinthehall.ca. Women's voices are finally being heard in many areas of society where they used to be silenced. But there are some voices from the past that still deserve a listen. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Women are speaking louder than ever in certain areas of society. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Sarah Finley, assistant professor of Spanish at Christopher Newport University, explores how a certain group also spoke loud, but without a voice.
Just as the audibility of women's voices is important in today's society, the topic also resonated with nuns in colonial Mexico. Convent rulebooks mandated reverent silence during meals, prayer, and daily chores. Furthermore, ecclesiastical guidelines prescribe a quiet, calm, and agreeable demeanor as ideal for religious women. From this perspective, convents were spaces of silence and contemplation. Nonetheless, other sources offer evidence to the contrary. Tolling bells and liturgical chants ordered daily routine, and accounts of spiritual and quotidian life in religious women's writing are replete with auditory references. Moreover, tales of a thriving music culture behind convent walls contrast with ideas about women's silence. With these apparent dissonances in mind, I use sources like visual art, descriptions of music making, and ideas about how harmony ordered the divine universe to reconstruct Mexican nunneries' vibrant sound culture. My first project takes a fresh look at sound in poet and nun Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz's writing. One of the most important authors of the Hispanic Baroque, Sor Juana is known for her defense of women's intellectual pursuits. I examine links among the author's auditory imagery and subjects like acoustics, cognition, writing, or visual art to draw out sound's role in refiguring gender. Subsequently, I work with music colleagues to bring 18th-century sound cultures to life through lecture recitals. These concerts tell the story of previously unedited music, and attendees delight in unexpected elements. For example, concertgoers might find themselves singing pedagogical exercises from early Mexican women's conservatories. In sum, my research enables voices past to resonate once more with the lively soundscapes of their origin.
That was Sarah Finley of Christopher Newport University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.